Yeah, the damned came from looking at the Blessed of December right off the bat.
Interesting.
And what that character looks like on the table, and knowing that that process in the story of how to create a Blessed probably wasn't just a perfect thing. So, you know, what does the first version look like, you know?
Yeah.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Normally, I record an episode, and then it takes several weeks, even months, before that episode is released. I just recorded this episode and could not sit on it, so you're going to hear it just days after it was recorded. This is an Insider Insights with Matt and Kyle from Weird Games. We start off sitting down talking about where the idea of their newest faction, Explorers, came from for Malifaux. I walk through the conception, how it got fleshed out, and how they ended up becoming a real thing. We learn about their process, what they go through from concept to finished product. We walk through each one of the new masters in the faction. We finish off talking about how to handle feedback and how do they listen to what people say, how do they filter it out. We even touch on when do they finally stop and go, you know what? This model needs an errata and we need to pay attention to it. Stick around to the end. I ask both of them what they're excited about, and both Kyle and Matt reveal some new information for a lot of Malifaux fans. Confirmation of things we suspected and some things we didn't expect. So don't miss it. Sit back, learn about the process that Kyle and Matt go through to create a brand new faction. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Now, anyone that plays Malifaux is excited now that the new faction Explorers have been released. With the faction book out in the wild, it was time to get the designers back on the show to learn how this new faction came to life. Now, Matt Carter and Kyle Rowan are the designers at Weird Games. They've both been on the show a few times now and even gave us some live commentary on the game we broadcasted for Gen Con. So we'll start with you, Matt. Welcome back to the Third Floor.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's always a fun time.
So out of curiosity, Matt, I know you've been doing some things with Malifaux, but I'd be curious, what else you've been doing to entertain yourself gaming-wise?
It's a lot more video games, unfortunately. I can't get to the game store. And any Malifaux that I have been playing is on Vassal, which I really appreciate having that there. Just being able to like playtest, having to learn Vassal and just being like, oh yeah, I can just put models in and then playtest new things with my playtesters, even though like they don't exist.
that is nice.
It is nice to be able to have that resource at our fingertips. But other than that, just a couple of video games. So
what video games are you playing, Matt?
Recently I've been playing the Marvel Ultimate Alliance game on Switch and nice. A lot of Destiny.
Oh really?
Yeah,
very, very good. I've never played Destiny. I've heard it's good though.
It is quite fun.
Yeah, I hear it's a time suck too. I can hear it in your voice.
It is absolutely a time suck.
That's funny. So our other guest, of course, is Kyle Rowan. And Kyle, welcome back to the Third Floor.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
So same question to you, my friend. Other than making kick-ass Malifaux stuff, what have you been keeping yourself busy with?
Well, as far as tabletop stuff, most recently I scooped up Thousand Year Vampire, which is a solo RPG, really kind of a crazy concept where you play as a vampire. It's kind of a writing exercise of a game, but you lose memories as you go on. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it's a really neat concept. The writing in it is really esoteric, and I just enjoy that, like the lost words and that sort of stuff. And then like Matt, I'm also diving deep into video games, most recently Demon Souls. I I guess I'm a sadomasochist. I just like getting crushed over and over again, but I'm having a lot of fun in that.
So I've been getting into RPGs a lot lately too with the COVID stuff, Kyle, and I've heard of solo RPGs, but literally have no idea what the hell that means. Like, I know what the words mean, just not put together. So like, what are you doing? What is a solo RPG and how does that work?
Think of it as essentially a writing exercise. It allows you to stretch those muscles a little bit. And I don't know, I do a lot of writing for Weird, but it allows me to do it in a more creative space, something where I don't feel quite as limited by, you know, the structures of Malifaux or the other side, yep. You know, that sort of thing. It just lets me do whatever I feel like doing. And there are rules and stuff like that. You know, it's not just an organized creative writing thing. And this is the first time I've played a solo RPG, so I'm certainly not an expert on it.
Right.
The experience has been unique enough that it's kept me flipping pages. So
now, is it like a choose your own adventure type thing where, you know, turn to page 37 if you do this, or is it really pretty freeform? Like, you make your character and it sets a scenario and you kind of write it yourself?
It's loose. There are choices made, there are outcomes that happen. So in some regards it's choose your own adventure, but it's a little bit more interpretive than that. And then some decisions that you make early on might end up changing your character later, or might end up being forgotten, you know, that really neat thing that you did a while ago ends up becoming a thing that you can no longer remember. And that's kind of the most interesting part about the game story wise, because you are playing as an immortal vampire across an 1,000-year stretch. So yeah, I'd recommend it.
Now, were you an RPG-er before this? Like, did you sit down and roll dice playing RPGs?
Oh yeah, yeah. I haven't played D&D in a while. Matt is probably sick of me talking about my favorite RPG, which is Blades in the Dark.
I've heard that's good. It has been sitting in my wish list for a long time. That's the heist one, right?
Yeah, it's so excellent. It's such a refreshing experience because, for one, the DM is essentially just improvising the whole thing, because it's up to the players what they're doing and the decisions that they're making and the types of heists that they're going to go do. And you know, the DM essentially can create and establish a world, but
right.
They're basically on the fly with like the decisions that are being made. And it's so much fun.
You're going to make me end up buying that damn thing. I've been so strong, but that sounds really good. Now, I've heard like the mechanics behind the planning and stuff. So like, you know, I've run heists in other RPGs as a GM, and what it often could turn into is, you know, seven sessions of the party doing nothing, because they are spent so much time planning and talking. What if this, what if that? So you end up doing nothing for like seven sessions. But from my understanding in Blades of the Dark, like there's a mechanical way to make sure that is handled. Is that right?
Oh yeah. The momentum never stops in the game. And even during like the downtime, when you're not doing heists, you're still doing important things. You're not spending time going from place to place. There's I imagine like a TV show almost, where right. The camera cuts from one screen to another. And there's a lot of that kind of embedded into the system. And so you're never bogged down with, we're walking on a trail for 3 hours, you know,
roll on the encounter table.
Right. Yeah. There's none of that.
Cool. I might have to poke around. Matt, did you ever get into RPGs? Do you play?
I haven't played in a bit of time. I'm actually starting up another RPG, 5th edition, in next couple of weeks. So that's exciting. Nice. I haven't played in a while, but I've always been like a 5th edition kind of person. I never really like deviate that much. I know several years ago I played the Star Wars RPG a bit.
Yep.
And I know you're a big fan of that.
So. I am. Yep. Very, very nice. In fact, have just not only am I a huge fan of that, I've become such a huge fan of the dice system that Star Wars RPG uses, that narrative dice system, that I ended up picking up the Genesis which is their generic. Basically, they took the Star Wars game, stripped out Star Wars, and let you set it anywhere. And I just recently started doing it in a fantasy world. That's very, very cool. So, guys, the kind of the goal of the Insider Insight series is to talk to people in the tabletop gaming industry and learn how they got into the business, what is their approach to the work they do, and really to understand their overall philosophy. It's a little bit different here with Matt and Kyle because they've been on the show and we've talked through a lot of that. So really what we're going to focus on today is we're going to focus on the explorers. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I'm going to learn how the whole concept of explorers were born. We'll be right back. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes. All right, so there was a day where the explorers were just something that we saw in Through the Breach, that we heard about them tangentially in some of the lore stories that were written. But at some point, somebody in the office said, you know what? I think explorers should be the new faction. So Kyle, can you take me back to that day?
Right. So at that point we were still kind of contemplating what was going to be the eighth faction. It was pretty clear that we were going to be including an eighth faction, but it was still a matter of what. And at that point it was a toss up between the Explorer Society or, actually splitting up the Arcanists into MNSU and the Arcanists.
Oh, nice.
And it just ended up to ultimately ended up being more interesting for us to the Explorer Society, which at the time were called the Malifaux Exploration Society. It's a bit more of a mouthful. Was just a bigger playground for us to kind of explore. And there were some overlaps with some concepts with what we wanted to do in the MNSU versus Explorer Society, like Condor Rails, like whichever direction we went in, we knew we wanted to include them because they were kind of just an important facet of the game that hasn't been explored enough. So we dived in, or dove in pretty heavily this time around into them. But yeah, the more we kind of talked things over, the clearer it became that the Explorer Society was just ultimately a more interesting route for us.
Yeah, yeah. So Matt, I'd be curious, like, how does the process start at that point? Like, I literally would have no idea where you guys even begin. So you say, okay, let's explore explorers. Let's look at that as potentially the eighth faction. What's step number two?
So we had, there was not like one general thing that we did. We had a bunch of stuff that we did all at the same time in order to kind of prepare for them. Now, granted, like we had decided upon explorers before third edition really pushed super far forward. So Bass and McCabe, like both of them, we knew we wanted to have explorers by the time we started really working on them. But there were a couple key things that we looked at. So like Condor Rails, we had, be like, okay, we really want to do them. So because of how they exist in lore, and so we'll work with what they have and kind of expand on that and see what we can do there. And then also, what does the Explorer Society already have? What can we pull from that to kind of do certain things? So we knew Lord Cooper existed, but we didn't really know a lot about him. And right. So we want to expand on that story. And then the last question is like, okay, well, those are like two keywords. We need several more. So one of the things we asked was like, what are the explorers exploring? And so we kind of looked at like different biomes to an extent.
Okay.
But that, even saying like biomes is kind of not exactly correct, because in the end, like Ivan is exploring like shadows, and Anya is exploring the biome of money. And so it's not really like a location or anything that we're right. looking at, but we kind of like, where have we not gone in Malifaux? We haven't seen the ocean. So us talking about that is a really interesting place. And then as the Explorer Society, like, what are they? They're this kind of rich group of hunting gentlemen. How do they get their money? What do they do with the information they know? All of these are where we kind of spread out our little fingers to explore the different keywords.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting, Kyle, as you start to kind of piece through that, like, where does mechanics start to pop up versus, you know, lore wise? Like, for example, if when you knew Cooper, right, you said, okay, Cooper is somebody that we kind of know a little bit about. Do you start fleshing him out thematically first and then bring in mechanics to support the thematics? Or do you say, this is a mechanic that we've had on the shelf or I'm just thinking about right now, and I wonder if it fits with Cooper? I'm trying to marry the two in my head.
One thing that kind of makes Matt and I work so well together is that we both have very different approaches to that. I'm very much a theme first person. I need the story first so that I can wrap in mechanics and ideas into that. And I don't want to say Matt is on the other side of the coin, but he's more mechanics driven than I am. And
that's a good balance to have.
So, I mean, Cooper, for example, we knew that from early story bits in early editions of Malifaux, we knew that he was a safari hunter. We knew that he was the creator of the Explorer Society. But there really wasn't much more than that. We roughly kept the timeline of development from, you know, book release to year in Malifaux. So we knew that a significant amount of time had passed in, right. in that. So in Malifaux, bad things happen, anything can happen. And there was so much room for us to explore with what the character was and what we wanted to make him. If players are familiar with just that initial bit from way back when, he's a wildly different character now. I mean, mentally, maybe not so much, but certainly physically. I'll leave the story itself speak on that a bit.
Well, and that ties into something that I've been doing, Kyle, and you and I talked about a little before we started recording is, and they haven't been released yet, but I've been interviewing some of the writers that have written for you guys. And one of the things that has come up more than once is how they interact with you guys, you give them the seeds, you give them some parameters, and then the writers go. Then you have editorial control and you go back and forth with them. At what point do you bring in other people outside of the two of you to say, we need to flesh this out more? Do you wait till you fully formed a character before you start creating some of the writing that we ended up seeing in the faction book? Or do some of these writers either inside of Weird or some of the freelance people, do they participate in the ultimately what say Cooper looked like at the end?
I'd say that it's kind of a balance between the two. Sometimes we have a really clear vision of where we want to take a character, in which case we do provide those little bits as often as we can. And other times, one of our writers will come up with a character idea a few years ago and we just end up using them now. For example, created Jesse in an old Chronicles story. He introduced the character again in the McCabe story, and it just made a whole lot of sense to introduce that character into the Explorer Society as a model. There's wiggle room between that,
right?
We try to create it as create a space that's collaborative with our writers. So if they have a really great idea, we're not just going to shut it down. We want to listen to it and maybe build on it.
Well, what's neat about that is, in conversations that we've had before, you guys have talked about how sometimes you'll think about a mechanic and you'll go, this doesn't really fit, and you'll put it away. And sometimes it comes back. It's interesting to see, even from a lore perspective, how characters can sometimes do that as well. We now know you're the mechanic of the team. So Kyle is the dreamer and the storyteller. you're the guy that actually puts the wrenches and the grease on it. When do mechanic, like, how do you start introducing mechanics? Do you say, okay, Kyle says, look, here's Cooper. This is what Cooper looks like. This is what he feels like. And you go, okay, like, how do we make that fit? Or do you say, Kyle, I've got this great idea for like a design space. Where can we put it? How do we marry this?
Yeah, it kind of goes both ways. Kyle will also probably agree that my ideas are very crazy compared to his. He's a lot more tamer in what he will come up with. And so I might say, like, here, I have this absolutely insane idea. And then Kyle will be like, okay, that doesn't really work, but like maybe we could work with something there. And then I'll be like, okay, so I have this thing, and we'll kind of talk about any characters that we already have that we might not know where they want to go, or if we have a role open. So when we're working on new masters and Explorer Society, if one of the masters, if we just kind of were like, yeah, we have five of them done, but we don't know necessarily what this last one is going to do, we'll kind of slot maybe something in there. But for the most part, mechanics will come after initial concepts. It because of how story like related the mechanics are to the gameplay, we don't want something to really change what like the story that we want to do. So if I'm doing mechanic, it's based on the vision of the character that we already have. We generally don't change the vision of the character because of a new mechanic.
Got it.
Granted, that's not exactly always the case. So there are some characters like Cadmus and Nexus as a whole that warped throughout the entire process based on like what mechanically could fit compared to like what couldn't. And then also, here's this cool idea. And then, well, you told me this cool idea, but I didn't do it. I did something else, but it's also really cool. And so all of these things kind of come in and out of each other throughout the entire process, from initial concept to a basic art description to actually seeing a line art of the character. All of those things will impact what their card looks like. And even to like small things of like, I see a line art and like, oh, this character doesn't have a gun. I guess they need a gun of some sort if it's really prevalent on their character.
Yeah.
But generally for like keywords as a whole, we had a good idea what the different characters might be in that keyword before we started the mechanics on them.
Got it.
But I think most of the keywords, we had like one or two, like, we'll fill this in later down the road when we have more of a grasp of what we want to do here.
I'd be curious, Kyle, was there, as you guys really started the process, was there particular things that you wanted to explore? I keep using explore with explorers. I can't avoid it. was there design spaces that you said, you know, I hope we hit these notes. I hope we hit these beats, or I hope we really kind of dig into these ideas. You know, as you look back on it, what were some of the early design goals or spaces that you wanted to dig into?
The most obvious one that I can think of is the one we didn't really talk about at all. We kind of wanted the book to do the revealing in itself, and that's Jedza and the Seekers. They're a very strange concept in how they function on the table. I mean, it's straightforward once you see it, but they're heavily heal oriented, and we don't really see that in Malifaux. Conceptually, that character started as one thing very different and ended up into something that I'm super proud of. Jez is one of my favorites in the society. But we knew going in, we wanted to explore the idea of an immortal character that is healing those around them in a very strange but interesting way. You know, it's one thing to just say, you know, heal one, but it's another right. thing to do what she's doing now, which also changed like 8 to 10 times in the playtesting process to get right. Because it, how do you actually make an immortal character on the table?
Right.
That's the that was a conundrum that Matt solved. So
well, you guys already have Colette, so technically this is the second immortal character that's right, on the table, right? Right?
You say that, and then Colette meets Tara and her gang, and Colette dies.
Oh, I had to get an Arcanist joke in there somewhere. So the last little bit before we take a break I want to talk about is, you know, one of the design goals that we talked about when we talked about third edition, when you guys came on to talk about that, was, you know, the idea of streamlining without dumbing down the game. But now we're opening up a whole bunch of new masters, a whole new faction with some new mechanics and things like that. What does that editing process look like, Matt, where you say, you know what, we don't want to, you know, make this game more complicated, but we want to have more things for our players to do. What is that process like? The self-editing.
Yeah, well, it's hard because whenever we want to introduce a new character, like, they can't play like someone else. We don't want to just be like, well, Jedza is just Dreamer also at the same time. Right. Like, they have to play an entirely new way. And so finding a balance there is very difficult. At the same time, like, even new actions and abilities and all those things, generally, when we're starting with these characters, they'll start really unique in a way. They'll mm-hmm. have a whole bunch of uniqueness to them, and we'll try to dumb it down so that we don't have 18 versions of Hard to Wound, for example.
Right.
But when we do that, these characters, sometimes we're just like, we really enjoy how this works, and even changing one word to make it the correct common way might not really play into how we want the character to be balanced. And so that's always kind of this tier seesaw that we have to play with. But it is not easy. That's the word I'm looking for. It's not easy to like say this character is going to do this thing that is slightly different than what everyone else is doing. So we try not to do that. Obviously, Explorers has more of that than others, but also when we were designing the Explorers models themselves, it was after all of the M3E models came out. So we had the ability to look back and be like, okay, is this wording the exact wording that is the best going forward? And so some of these changes are just us getting better designing M3E and being able to say, like, this is a better way to write this. And then other times it's us just being like, while it might maybe better, we're going to keep the common vernacular so that we don't introduce so many things. There were a lot of examples where like a character would have a more well thought out ability that works in a slightly different way. But we and ended up deciding like it's not that important to that character to work in this slightly different way. So we'll pull it back.
Right.
But at the same time, like we introduce a lot of new markers and that kind of stuff, but we also introduce some of the same things at the same time. So shadow markers come back. For instance, when we were working on Ivan, we looked at Misaki and we're like, okay, we have these shadow markers. We don't want to change how they fundamentally work because that would be strange.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those are the same thing. And then we also looked at Misaki's triggers, and a lot of them are like, hey, a friendly shadow marker. So Ivan's shadow markers generally deal with only friendly versions because we made this decision
to label them
with or without the forethought to have Ivan going forward.
So Kyle, Matt comes to you with the craziest mechanic and you're like, that is bonkers. What is the process of editing Matt's ideas like? How do you tone them down and make them actually usable?
That's still something I'm trying to learn.
Can I get back to you on that, Craig?
I can't think of a specific instance.
Remember the time we were like, hey, let's make Jedza have an aura that says no one can die?
Yeah, there was that. So that was one of the crazy ideas that started off with Jedza. It went into playtesting that way, and we made it work. But ultimately, it was a fun issue. That version ended up changing into what you see now, which is more life token oriented, because fun happens on both sides of the table. And that goes again into taking a crazy idea like an immortal character in a competitive game and making it work.
What I think is neat about it is that it still thematically feels that way, even though mechanically it might not be, which is something that, you know, Malifaux has always excelled at, I think, is that, you know, everything feels unique. And it's not only do the factions feel unique, but more importantly, within the faction, everybody feels unique, even after the streamlining of M3E. So there's a little bit of smoke that I can blow up you guys. You guys do a very good job of marrying the two of those. So guys, what we're going to do, we're going to take a break. And we get back from this break, I want to start breaking down and talking a little bit more specific about some of these keywords. So we're going to come back and we're going to talk about Anya and English Ivan. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats. Save yourself some money and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So the first one I want to talk about is Anya and the Syndicate. So Kyle, I'm going to go to you for the lore piece. At first, if somebody has never heard of Anya, doesn't have the book yet, where does Anya and the Syndicate fit in? Fit in as far as explorers and fit in as far as overall in the world of Malifaux?
So before you can talk about Anya, you have to talk about Condor Rails, which is the rail conglomerate that she now is responsible for running. Which was introduced in the Arcanist book, Into the Steam and Through the Breach. And it was originally run by Anya's father. And there is a brief cameo of him in the Pandora story with an open ended, what happened to him, sort of thing. And all of a sudden we have Anya. So it's, I'll let players kind of come to their own conclusions on that one. But she's kind of a rising star in the Explorer Society. She runs things a little bit differently than her father, a little bit more aggressively. And you can see that a little bit on the table. Essentially the Condor Rails, if there's a train track in Malifaux, it's operated by them. So them being a part of the Explorer Society allows them to literally explore any aspect of the world. So
I'd be interested, Matt, like thematically. So if someone said, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, buying the Syndicate box and playing them, but I don't really know kind of how they feel, how would you describe what playing Syndicate is like?
Yeah, so there's an action on Anya's card that the name of it, I think it does a good job at explaining what Anya does, which is Hostile Takeover. That to me is all about kind of being fast and brutal in taking territory and control of characters. So Anya, as a keyword with all of her syndicate, is very, very quick and very good at taking out certain characters that they want to and controlling specific areas. They do that with their ski markers, with Anya having expansionist, all of these abilities that really hamper your opponent from getting to where they want to and controlling the area of the board that you already have. But at the same time, we didn't want to make them like so overly powerful. So one of their issues is that they're not exceptionally tanky. And they actually have to spend their health in order to do things as sort of this price of the blood that they have to give for the company that they have. So.
And that, I think what's neat about that is it takes a resource that already exists, which is a health resource, right? Every model has that as a resource. But the decision making that needs to happen, I think, is interesting in the way that leverages out. So, Kyle, if what are you excited about people discovering? So a lot of people listening right now have not played Anya, but they will be, you know, seeing Anya on the table and they'll be playing it. What are you excited about them discovering about that keyword?
Well, Matt sort of covered it as far as mechanics go. I think Glass Cannon Melee is going to be an interesting challenge for players to figure out, but she is brutal. I think figuring out how she has managed to combine interests and essentially buy out the Catalin, which we'll see in the Outcast starter box coming out later. Which they'll have the syndicate keyword. So it's an interesting little tie-in there. Seeing how the models like Surveyors tie into both Anya mechanically and Jedza, and figuring out how they work in very different spaces will be a lot of fun. But and then there's also the giant Thunderbird, you know, Sovereign and for opponents figuring out how to take out, you know, a mechanical condor.
I can't wait to see that model. I'm so excited about seeing that model because the art looks so good. And the mechanics of that model are very, very cool to think about. Matt, what do you think initial reactions are going to be people playing against Syndicate?
People playing against Syndicate?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that playing against Syndicate, you have to realize is that the individual models themselves, they like to kind of get out on their own and kind of like Anya is very good at getting past her enemies into their opponent's deployment zone, scheming while also being a big damage threat. Sovereign is the same way. But these characters are fairly easy to take out if you have the right tool. So Sovereign only has 6 HP. If you can do ping damage to him, if you can bring anything that gets past armor, anything like just mass amounts of attacks, it's defense 4,
right?
In the end, those things are how you're going to beat Syndicate. But at the same time, if you can lure them to all fight in one area, that's what they don't want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Anya is very good at maneuvering and pushing around her allies, as well as the rest of the other characters, dealing with like hazardous terrain, pushing you into hazardous terrain, moving you through all this stuff. If you can force them into one spot, that will be a good way to fight them. It's what they don't want to be doing. They want to hit you and keep going.
Very, very interesting. So thematically, let's go to a completely different keyword. I want to talk about the DIA and the Umbra keywords in English Ivan. Can you tell me, Matt, kind of where does English Ivan fit into the world of Malifaux?
So yeah, English Ivan is a character that we introduced a long time ago. I can't remember the exact book. Kyle, can you?
Another first edition character.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah. He's had ties with Ramos. He's had ties with Lucius. He's had ties with Mei Feng most recently. And it's been one of those characters that players have wanted to see on the table for years. And this was just the most opportune time to see him. So
that's cool. And Matt, how would you describe these keywords? Well, first of all, let's talk about it because there are two different keywords, right?
Yeah, so he has the DUA keyword and the Umbra DUA, keyword.
I said DIA, sorry. DUA, go ahead, I'm sorry.
He has the DUA and the Umbra keyword, and they kind of represent the two halves of his crew. So DUA represents the Department of Ungentlemanly Affairs, which are these sort of spies and thieves that are very good at doing heists and getting to where they want to, controlling various aspects of the board. But then you have the Umbra keyword, which are these shadow creatures that Ivan is summoning into battle based on various things that he has picked up over the years that aren't necessarily good things. Mm-hmm. Even to the point that Ivan's totem, Mr. Mordrake, is Ivan's own shadow fighting at his own side, and will eventually bite back Ivan. So as a full grouping together, they kind of have to balance off each other, because the Umbra models are generally where you're going to be getting the kind of front facing combat forward set. Most of them have 0-inch melee, pretty low speeds, but the DUA models are kind of there to help set them up. And they get a lot of benefits from them being there already with their Ungentlemanly Affairs ability, keying off the concealment that they get. And so it's really playing into how much do I have to go into both sides? And you really want to have a nice balance between the two of them.
So any predictions, Kyle, on what people are going to really dig as they play English Ivan and his keywords?
I hope players are going to like the Brock Inspector. I mean, some players will, other players, as in the opponents, will probably hate them. they're big, and they're gonna have a lot of impact on the table. I think the most fun for me is the idea of peeling shadows off of your opponents to summon. I think that was a really great mechanic to tie in thematically. And I'm just excited to see kind of how players are able to bend that in interesting ways. And for players who are interested in the lore, you know, we're seeing not only Ivan, but we're also seeing DeWalt and Havenhand on the table, and their interactions with how they're reacting to essentially this changed man, because for the longest time he was just the Department of Ungentlemanly Affairs, and something clearly happened to him, but they're still along for the ride. There's a lot going on with Ivan, and
so generally speaking, one thing, and this applies to everybody, it's not just these two masters and keywords, how important was it, and maybe it was not important at all, for you guys to add models to the explorers that could be utilized elsewhere? So shared keywords. Was that something where you said, yeah, we definitely want to, you know, bring some new models to other keywords via the explorers? Or did it just, because we know it happened, but I'm trying to get a sense of whether that was a goal or whether you just went, you know what, thematically or mechanically, these guys really fit, you know, with this other keyword.
Yeah, for me, like, some of it, like, yeah, we do want to have dual keyword models that breach in other factions. Like, we're not going to just do none of them, but it wasn't a goal of ours to have all of many as possible. Like, there's not that many in Explore Society, because we really wanted them to stand on their own. We didn't want people to see them as another coming of Ten Thunders, where everything is dual faction. Because, like, they're their own people, and the dual keyword characters that exist, those are generally there for a very specific reason, lore wise. So like Corvus Rook and the operatives, we felt like they had a really interesting place of like, here's this big business conglomerate. They have to do some shady things, so they go to the shady people to do that. And so that's where those two people come in. And so when you have Corvus Rook, who is essentially a cleaner, coming in for, and he kind of fits in both of these places, and the operatives felt really interesting, and we really liked the mechanics of what they were bringing. We were like, okay, what if we have this character who's not actually who they say they are, where do they fit? And it just kind of fit naturally in these two keywords that we're talking about.
Yeah. And I would imagine, Kyle, that, you know, initially, you know, the idea of having multiple keywords on the same model seems, you know, super flexible and it's exciting, but I would also imagine it restricts you as well, right? So you're in a situation where you now have to think of them not only in the keyword for the Explorer Master, but the keyword and how they're going to interact with that whole other keyword that they share. So I would imagine that's got to be a challenge for these, isn't it?
Yeah, and one in particular I can think of is a cross-faction model, and that's the Damned. The Damned crosses over, has the savage keyword, so he plays well with Euripides. And for the longest time, we were bouncing back and forth on, you know, should it be a Neverborn model with the Seeker keyword? Should it right. be an Explorer Society model with the Savage keyword? And I think we ultimately settled in on the right decision, but it wasn't an easy one, you know, because of what he potentially could bring to Neverborn, being, you know, so heavily leap oriented and that sort of thing. But we also didn't want to have Neverborn players lean on that character too much.
Right.
He is very powerful, and he's going to be a great fit for Savage. But we didn't want, when we want to create a powerful character, we do have to be very careful about where it can be exploited. So that's ultimately where that decision came into play.
Craig, I will say, sometimes restrictions make it way easier to make a character. Because you're just like, oh, I have to do these two things. Okay. That works. It's pretty simple.
Done.
If it's just like, oh, I have to do something totally unique.
Oh, and right.
Not fix it. Like, be like, where like a dual keyword character can be like, Euripides' crew is kind of slow. So maybe we make a character that's not slow for him.
Yeah.
And it comes pretty easy in that way. But
knowing what the gap is you're trying to fill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Damned came from looking at the Blessed of December right off the bat.
Interesting.
And what that character looks like on the table. And knowing that process in the story of how to create a Blessed probably wasn't just a perfect thing. So, you know, what does the first version look like, you know?
And yeah.
Jedza walks over it and suddenly it's alive again. So,
so not happy.
Yeah.
Well, and really when you guys got rid of the mercenary stuff from 2E, you know, that was one of the things that you guys mentioned was that, you know, you had to, from a design space, you know, kind of simplify that. And the idea of, you know, having somebody being able to be hired by just about anybody and dealing that. And, you know, when we talked about in the previous episodes about the tax and how you guys manage that. So that makes total sense to me. So guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to explore Jedza and Lord Cooper. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Doug. And I'm a $5 patron of Third Floor Wars because Craig promised he'd play as the Arcanist if the Patreon reached $300.
I want to see him suffer.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth a dollar a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There, you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. Need to give a quick shout out to some of our newest patrons. A big thank you to Anthony, Alexander, Michael, Bob, Old Doc Fulton, Joseph Pye, Loke Walmo, Nicholas Prinzing, Dearth8952, Mike, Peter Darmus, Eli, and KC. Because of you guys and the 100-plus others, we're able to put out consistent content on a regular basis. We appreciate it. So we've already talked about Jedza a little bit, but I want to dig into a little bit deeper. So it's really kind of the same thing we've been doing before, Kyle. Where does Jedza and the Seeker keyword fit within the world of Malifaux? Lore-wise, who is Jedza?
Well, that's a question that we're kind of keeping a closed door on still.
Come on, just get it all out right now.
A few things that we do know. We do know that she is incredibly old, that she is, if not immortal, very close to being immortal, and that she's not from Malifaux. We do know that she's from Earth first. How all of that kind of unfolds, you're going to have to kind of read some bios and you're going to have to read her story. There are some relationships that might surprise players with who she's comfortable working with and who she absolutely hates. Interestingly enough, though, Jedza didn't start that way. It wasn't always like this character that we wanted to we didn't always want to go in that direction. One thing I wanted to do very early on was create kind of a silly safari-esque necropolis explorer character with almost like
just,
you know,
a skeleton in a cat with a vacation shirt on.
Right. Yeah. Kind of like a borderline ridiculous thing. And it was too ridiculous. So we ended up, I don't want to say grounding Jedza, because Jedza is also probably just as equally as ridiculous, but in a much darker way, which is more appropriate to Malifaux. And, you know, we do like to have fun, but generally it's more like Earl Burns or the Bayou or something like that. And there are some ridiculous models. Like there's that one tiny lamplighter who may or may not be a gremlin. Who knows what's underneath that. So
though, that's another, those lamplighter art is like, as I can't wait to see the sculpts.
Yeah.
They are my absolute favorite piece of art.
Yeah.
I think lamplighter number one is very good in my opinion.
Yeah. They just drip thematics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just imagining them as models is super excited. So Matt, how would you categorize the seeker keyword? If someone's going to play this keyword, what are they going to, what kind of weapons are they wielding?
The weapons of not dying. If you are frustrated by your opponent alpha striking you constantly, this is a good keyword to play. They're very good at standing there and taking hits. They're very good at controlling small areas that they can get to. They're really good if you just want to make it through the game. Which some people, that is their goal, is to not die.
Yeah.
I can relate to that fully, having played against my fair share of like super alpha Nakima lists that I'm just like, okay, I'm playing this game right from the start of turn one. How do I survive to turn two?
Yeah.
Jedza will do that for you mechanically.
And Mikhail. Yeah. If Jedza doesn't, Mikhail will. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Mikhail is also great.
Is there a particular seeker model that you think is going to end up causing a lot of conversations or get people really excited? Something that maybe someone who just got the book and was flipping through it maybe didn't pick up on?
I think mechanically, in terms of like power, Mikhail will see a lot of table time. He is very, very strong. I'm happy about that for the most part. We're really excited about him as a character. But in terms of weirdness, the Grave Goo is chef's kiss amazing, in my opinion. Like, is just great. Because we really went with that one. We were like, okay, we have this goo that for some reason we had decided to want to use. I can't remember how we decided to be like, yeah, this is what we want to use here.
I wanted that character in Malifaux for the longest time. It's been a part of Through the Breach, and it's just such this weird thing that was in Rottenburg that I just wanted to include from the start. It was just a matter of where to include it, and it made sense.
And then mechanically for the Grave Goo, I kind of looked back at like the gelatinous ooze for fifth edition. Like, how do you fight against just a ball of goo? What does it do to you? And I like the idea of it like trapping you inside. And I asked myself, like, okay, once you're trapped inside, how do you get out? I'm like, okay, you should be able to crawl out, but I really like the idea of your buddy like reaching in and pulling you out. So that's all where that kind of came from. I was like, what is the most ridiculous way this character works on the table? And I hope people play him and get a lot of play out of that just ridiculous piece engulfing their friends.
Well, and it sounds like when they take that action to pull them out, they've got to make a sound effect, right? To get the full effect of just the pulling out of the goo.
There's a squelch. Yeah.
It's very gross.
And I will say it also, like, that character designing him had a lot of impact with another set of characters, Beeb and Calypso, because they kind of have similar mechanics but backwards, where Beeb and Calypso are all about like, I'm gonna get in this and be happy and be safe, where if you, the Grave Goo is like, I'm gonna pull you in into the most unsafe place. And so they sort of mirror each other, and they were when writing them, their mechanics kind of balanced out in a way of like, okay, if I'm gonna write it this way, I need to write it here, and then this problem showed up here, I bet it will also show up here. So always figuring those two things out.
Very, very cool. So another keyword we want to talk about is the Apex keyword, Lord Cooper. Now, we saw them in action on the Gen Con live stream, so we saw how cool they are. You know, compared to, say, especially like when we're talking about the Seekers, a little bit more straightforward mechanically. But Lord Cooper was talked about early on, Kyle. Way back when, and you said that, you know, lore wise he changed a lot through the process of actually making him a master in a keyword.
So again, I won't go deep diving into his lore. I don't want to cheat players of finding those story bits. But there's a lot that has happened to Cooper, clearly. You can see it in the art, for starters. He's got some machine parts, you know, and you have to figure out how and why that happened. And now he's also not the leader of the Explorer Society. We see another character in the story, Gretchen, who is starting to run the show a little bit. But as far as on the table goes, we knew that we have to have a fluctuation across our masters in every faction of simple and complex. And we have arguably one of the more complex characters in Malifaux in Nexus, I'd say. And to combat that, we did want to make sure that Cooper and EVS, for example, are a little bit more straightforward to play. He's not quite, you know, point and shoot. He's got a right. lot going on with him, you know, with adversary and the snipers that are with him doing some interesting things. You know, a giant T-Rex, what does that look like on the table? But we did know that we wanted to keep him fairly straightforward so that players of all types could enjoy the new faction, not just players who want the high level, how complex can we make Malifaux sort of thing. So.
Sure. Sure. In your mind, Matt, what kind of player is going to enjoy playing Apex?
To me, it's the kind of player that wants to be able to do well without, without just frying their brain. I think everyone has kind of gone to a tournament that's just like, here's five rounds over the course of like 2 days. And by the end of it, you're completely dead.
Yeah.
And we wanted to, granted, Malifaux's never going to get to the point that you're going to be able to play without thinking. Yep. But we wanted a character that if he has a big gun, you point the big gun and shoot at people. And that is a way to just win with Cooper. There are a lot of other things to do with Cooper. There's a lot of different ways to play him. You can do like sort of pit traps and you can do this kind of beastie menagerie build. But the idea of like, he's a guy with a gun that shoots things is very, very simple. And sort of cathartic of just like, yeah, I want to kill that guy and it's going to feel good. Yep. But also in the same time, like we wanted people to feel like a hunter. One of my favorite like tiny bits about Cooper is that the only two named models other than Cooper and his crew are the dogs. It just kind of gives you a sense of like what kind of person Cooper is.
Yeah, he likes his dogs a lot more than he likes people. And you see that a little bit in his totems and in that contract that a couple hundred people may or may not have signed.
Those totems are super fun, by the way.
One of the big feedback we got from the live stream was people were really found how unique and interesting those totems worked and how different they were functionally. I'd be curious, Matt, when did they start to form or how long in the process before they ended up being where they are now?
So the idea of the runaways was actually really early on in Cooper's thought process. We were like, him hunting people sounds like a thing he would do. And is also like, oh, these people aren't on his team in the same way. That's not a thing that we've explored in Explorer Society or in Malifaux in general. And so they've changed a lot, but the core idea of they are not his buddies has kind of always been there. And at first, we kind of played with the idea of like this had a ability, something along the lines of like this model joins your opponent's crew. Mm-hmm. And becomes part of their crew the entire game. And that didn't end up working out But the core mechanic of them running away from Cooper and however they leave the table, whether you kill them, your opponent kills them, or they escape, all of them are good for you, bad for your opponent.
Right.
And so it's all about like the choices that are made between both players of what happens between them, because no matter what they do, it's bad for your opponent and good for you. And so it feels really good, even though like, yeah, you're hunting people. And that was also like, how do you make killing your own models feel cool?
Right. Well, and thematically and mechanically, right?
Yeah.
And even with that, you know, like Matt talked about very briefly about the what happened with playtesting and how we originally had them playing the other on the other side. And he said it didn't work, but it actually it did. It just wasn't fun. You know,
right.
And it ended up boiling down to that. Like, Matt can make any crazy idea work. that I have no doubt. But ultimately, giving the opponent essentially a chore just ended up bogging interest down for them.
I know one of the problems we also had with them was Cheeto fingers.
Right. Yeah. And especially now with everything going on, you know, it just didn't make sense to continue that idea.
Touch your nice painted models.
Right.
No, I am not a fan of that. So I'm glad you decided not to do that. All right. So the big question that everybody wants to know the answer is who's the first person that said, we need a dinosaur?
That was me.
Yeah.
Okay. So where does that come from, Matt?
I'm pretty sure I championed the dinosaur through the entire process, basically until the sculpt was done. Everyone's like, this is not going to work. We got the sculpt. Everyone's like, okay, yeah, the dinosaur. Pretty cool.
But to go from like Matt's crazy idea to what we have today, like it started off as 120 millimeter model, went to 80 mil, and then
started at 80.
Sure.
That did not work.
Sure.
Started 120.
Yeah, it started by a 3x3, you know. And
it was just a foot.
Right. Yeah.
Bring your own plastic T-Rex and just play Chomp Chomp on the table.
Oh, that's funny. In all seriousness, though, when did was Malosaurus always dual faction, or did that happen in the process? When did Fae become part of the keyword for the dinosaur?
As far as the lore goes, it was Fae first. It was a matter of how do we introduce this into the Explorer Society. The Malosaurus Rex was introduced in Jurassic Foe and Through the Breach adventure. We pull a lot of stuff from Through the Breach. There's some Explorer Society stuff in there as well. But you know, how did we introduce it to the Explorer Society? You get to see that a little bit in the Cooper story, in how he managed to wrangle one onto his side. But yeah, it was always Fae first. So I'm gonna
step in on Kyle's toes only because it was always not just Apex first. There was a time it wasn't always Fae specifically, and you can kind of call it out on this. At one point, it was a Chimera model, and then we realized that Marcus didn't really need the Malosaurus Rex.
I guess I mean more as like story related. Like it was always a part of the Wildlands in Titania's Forest. In that regard, it was always Fae.
I will say the Malosaurus being a Chimera model is something that makes me sad only when I look at the Arcanist faction book when the Malosaurus Rex art shows up. Where we're like, yeah, I mean, it does show up in these Wildlands, but it's not actually Chimera anymore. and so that was like, granted, like, I'm really happy with it being a Fae, and I think it makes the Fae crew, it brings a really interesting dynamic to them where I'm like, sometimes Marcus is just like, okay, yeah, I have the Sabertooth Cerberus already. And also like putting wings on the dinosaur all the time. Like you can still do it if you go the roundabout way of like, I'm going to play Titania and then bring Marcus and the dinosaur. You can still do it. But that was sometimes too much.
I'm sure. Oh, that's fun. So what I'm trying to figure out, and Matt, and I think you've hinted at it, but I want to spell it out. Did you see Malosaurus Rex in the Through the Breach material and go, that needs to come into Malifaux? Or did you say, we need a dinosaur?
I think I saw the Malosaurus Rex.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a craving for dinosaurs.
Okay.
I am not 100% positive, but I'm pretty sure I saw the Malosaurus Rex. And then I was just like, oh, let's do it.
Let's do it. That's cool. Well, guys, let's take another break. When we get back, we're going to talk about the last two. We're going to talk about Maxine and Nexus. We'll be right back.
Howdy friends, Craig here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code ThirdFloorFriend, all one word, ThirdFloorFriend, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats.
So poor Kyle is regulated as my lore master in this process. So Kyle, let's talk about Maxine and EVS. Where have we seen this before? Was this a brand new creation?
This was brand new. We wanted to dive into, one thing that we like to do when we research characters and ideas and come up with concepts is pull from the real world. And Maxine and her crew is heavily inspired by that. Beeb and Calypso, for example, that was a real scientist, and that was a real machine. That's the first bathysphere that was created.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Maxine Agassi is inspired by another explorer with the same name. Some of her background is inspired by that character, but you know, we wanted to take her in a slightly different direction, so it's more of inspired by, and maybe players can make those connections themselves. Kia came from other established lore that we created, you know, with Abyssinia. We wanted to see Abyssinian characters more in Malifaux, and what would that look like? Harada, Nagatoro, and his father are also established characters in our lore because of the Nagatoro sisters in the other side who ended up taking out Horimatangi way back when. So there's deep connections within that, and then also connections to real world history. Orville, I think, was just a wild idea. If I remember correctly.
Orville is named after a very famous Wright brother.
That's right. Yes, that's where his name came from. But I mean, the giant jetpack and tossing bombs. Yeah, that's.
Yeah. What does Maxine's totem look like? We'll give her Orville.
Right. Yeah.
That's very close to us here in North Carolina. That's where the Wright brothers and Kitty Hawk.
Excuse me, I'm from Ohio. I'm going to claim the Wright brothers.
This has been a long going feud, Matt. A long going feud between North Carolina and Ohio.
We have airplanes on everything. I think Maxine is also the first character that is canonically like married and is a master.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Wow.
Or that, like, we've talked about their marriage.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So thematically, Matt, from a gameplay standpoint, if somebody's playing EVS, what are they looking to put on the table?
In terms of like what kind of person like EVS? Sorry.
Sure. Yeah. What kind of person? What kind of style of play are we looking at? Some mechanical thematics?
So EVS was kind of very specifically designed as a motley crew of, if you have a ship, you have a bunch of different roles on that ship. And what do these roles look like? And it ends up with a crew that is fairly good at everything. In a similar, like, they're generalists in the same way, like Von Schiel is a generalist. Like, mm-hmm. He has a lot of different resources for everything. And for her and the EVS crew, we really wanted to focus on like, okay, they were there to be scientists. What does a scientist look like here? And so we kind of got this idea of like deep discovery and reconfigure, and we were like, okay, so here's these two different ideas. we'll do this one and see if it works. And then eventually we just like, what if we did both and we somehow connect them? And they're like, they're distinct and different, but they work together in interesting ways to make a crew that is very, very versatile, provided that they plan ahead, which is kind of what a scientist would want to do. That like, you have to have the ability to plan out your hand really, really carefully. And over the course of the turn, it will kind of make everything that you have very, very potent.
Interesting.
It makes for a really fun way to play, in my opinion, because yeah, they're very consistent if you plan enough ahead. And then Maxine is kind of there as a center point to be like, okay, not only can we plan ahead, but we can also kind of change up on the fly by drawing cards a little bit, but also during the middle of the turn, I can change my style. And that represents her as a character. She is a polymath. She is a genius in so many different subjects. So her ability to change how she thinks in the middle of the game was really, really important.
Very cool.
And it played into like this really cool mechanic of choosing a suit, and then each of the reconfigurers has their own suit, but hers changes, and then also her triggers and stuff change on that. It makes for her turn to be really, really interesting from game to game. It will kind of look the same, but also not look the same. And when she fights against an enemy, she can use the idea of like meta knowledge. What is this character good at doing mechanically in the game to her own advantage with her like two steps ahead ability of saying like, yeah, I'm fighting against a Neverborn character who primarily uses masks. They're not going to be as good against me. And that was just a really interesting concept that we kind of said, what's a scientist look like in the battlefield?
It is interesting. And I'll tell you that entire mechanic, right, of the choosing of the suits and that impacting what the values are going to be, is one of those things that you read it and you go, holy Christmas, that is the craziest thing. It's going to be so overpowered. But I've talked to people that have been playing EVS and they say it's a lot more restrictive than you think. It reads stronger than it plays, but it still works. Do you think that that's an accurate assessment?
Yes. And I think specifically it's because when people read it, they read it as all the cards I play of this suit are value 9. It's not that way. It's because you have to cheat. You do have to spend these resources, which is really where once you actually get it on the table, you notice when you're spending these resources and how you have to get them back. And so like, it is really easy to say this crew is crazy because of this rule and then put them on the table and be like, I ran out of cards.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So I've saved what I think is, at least initially, the master and the keyword that's getting the most buzz. I think people like myself that are, you know, love painting and love modeling are super excited about the look of Cadmus and Nexus. I know that a lot of the competitive people that I've been talking about won't shut up about Nexus and Cadmus. So for those that are listening, Kyle, that have never heard of Cadmus, where do they fit into Battlefell?
Well, Cadmus is what makes Cadmus the most unique, I'd say, is that when you say Cadmus and Nexus, you aren't talking about a single entity. We are bringing a hive mind into Malifaux, and Cadmus is the keyword and the character, and Nexus is just the nexus of that character, the part where they are the most vulnerable. Probably also one of the more complex characters in the Explorer Society because of how they function and how they can manipulate the opponents. And another one of those ancient characters that kind of was unearthed. The story behind it, I want to talk about it for hours, but I don't want to take that away from players. There's a ton of stuff to get from in the Explorer Society book. You get to see their interactions with people and with people that they've already kind of taken control over and what that looks like. And then we also got to highlight some other established characters within that crew, with like the Night Sail Creeper we were able to bring in to Malifaux, which was another established through the Breach character traditionally more Neverborn oriented, but as it turns out, these mites that Cadmus controls ends up combining in a very positive way for them with the Nightsoul Creeper, and that's where we get Nexus and why that aspect of the character is more potent than, say, taking over a regular person and becoming an Eyes and Ears or a Berserker Husk, which I don't know if you've seen the art. They're disgusting. They're awesome.
They're cool. They're right. Cool. Like I keep saying it through this whole episode. Like, I can't wait to see the sculpts. I mean, as soon as I got to see all of the artwork, I was like, wow, this is some crazy stuff. So this concept of this hive, Matt, how does that turn into actual models, and how does that turn into actual mechanics?
Well, it doesn't start as a concept of hive. That's how you do it. You evolve into that somehow.
Interesting.
Because originally there was an idea discussed on The Office of, what if we make this spider character that we had floating around? What if they eat people and steal their abilities? And we're like, okay, that's cool. And then I was writing that, and that became excessively complicated.
Yeah.
And it was really, really cool. But we were like, okay, how do we take this idea of like taking other people's stuff? And then I know we got to talking with a few of us, and the idea of this hive mind sort of evolved from that. And mechanically, we were like, okay, what does a hive mind need to work? It needs lots of parts of itself. It needs worker ants. It needs the ability to defend itself. And that's where all of these kind of different characters came in.
I'd say the only restriction we really had in the concept was we wanted to make sure it was as separate and different from Hamlin as possible.
Yes, interesting.
They're both very plague spready. And we wanted to approach that in a very different light, but
I will say Nexus is creepy, even amongst the Office. That whole group, they're all creepy.
Is there a particular Nexus model, Matt, that you're excited for people to try?
I like all of them. The Spell Eaters are really, really cool, in my opinion, and how they work, and the idea of how does magic work with a hive mind that's eating people, essentially. Mm-hmm. Not exactly, but the Nightsoul Creeper is really, really cool. The Archivist, they're all cool. Eyes and Ears are even cool. Like, they have their uses for what is essentially a random citizen of an LFO. So I don't have a favorite.
You like them all the same. So one of the things that has come up several times as I've had different designers on the show is a thing that I'm starting to term designer's armor, which is you create something and you put it out in the wild, and then the internet lights up and everybody starts giving their immediate hot take feedback. And it's been very interesting to me to hear how designers like handle that type, that just that rush and of feedback. So for you, Kyle, one, you know, when the book got out there, when the cards show up in the app, when there's pointed opinions that are being shared by content creators or, on AWP. And do you just not read it? Do you read it and, just absorb it, disregard some of it, take some of it to heart? I'm really interested in how, when you present your children to the world and you find out what their thoughts are, how do you handle that?
First, I read everything, and I probably shouldn't, but it doesn't affect me in the way that it affects some. I think that the process of development of a game ends up kind of turning you into Swiss cheese, because you're never going to hear anything worse than when you put something out into playtesting and it's like the raw alpha version. And, that's the feedback that you need the most, and it's the feedback that hurts the most, because it's here's this beautiful idea, guys, and they come back, it's like, no, this is busted or stupid, and what do I do with this? This doesn't actually work. It's like, oh, right. So having gone through that experience over and over and over again. Like you, I think it's a good phrase, designer's armor, is that, you know, you kind of get calluses from it.
Yeah.
I don't want to say you get numb from it, because, you know, that feedback is always going to make an impact to you.
Yep.
But it's not water off the back either. It's, you know, you learn from those things. Like if you make a design mistake here, you're not going to make that mistake again in the future.
Right.
But I'd say that there's nothing that anyone on AWP can say that a playtester hasn't always already said in a much worse way.
How about for you, Matt? How do you handle that? Just that the dam has broken and here comes all the feedback.
I also read all of it. I listen to all the podcasts. I do all of it and try to accept as much as possible. And I don't take it as gracefully as Kyle does, but I do try. So it's sometimes, yeah, it's not the best feeling in the world, but also then you see responses that are like, this is amazing. I want all these models. This is a really cool mechanic. How, like, what does this do? Like all these things. And that helps in such a better way, like such an exponentially better way to see positive feedback, that you kind of, for me, it's, I kind of just have to say, like, some people are not going to like anything because they just don't like things. They want to tear it to pieces.
Yep.
And being able to accept that, like, that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. And but, like, yeah, sometimes it's going to suck and sometimes it's going to be great. And you just kind of have to accept that for me. Sometimes it's really awesome. Sometimes it's meh, for a day, but
yeah. So I'd be interested, and this is for really for both of you. So there's one thing, you know, you put out a new keyword and, you know, everybody says this is busted. This is going to break the game and blah, blah, blah. Then they actually play it as opposed to just read the cards. And then, you know, usually a lot of times that changes opinions, right? When they actually see it instead of imagining it. But I would be curious to know, when does that noise actually filter down and how does it translate to potentially showing up in a errata later? I'd like to get an idea of what the gates in the channels are before you guys finally decide, you know what, we do need to look at this a little bit. Is there a litmus test that you guys apply, or do you just, you let the dust settle and explore it on your own, or how do you guys decide that?
I'd probably say it's a gut feeling. And maybe there's more of a science behind it or math that I haven't really thought about, but one character in particular that I could think about when we did an early reveal on is Winston Finnegan. We revealed that card and, the reaction wasn't what we expected. It was leaning pretty heavily into a negative way, and we had the opportunity to take a look at that character before it ended up getting released. And you'll see now, he's still powerful, but he's definitely more brought back down to earth a little bit. Sometimes things do get through. There's, with the amount of models that we have in the game and the size of the game, even with our incredible playtesters, it's inevitable that something's going to slip through. There's a combination out there that no one thought about until, you know, it's put through, you know, the grinder of a large community, in which case we address it.
It's impossible, Kyle. Let's be honest. It's impossible, right? I mean, there's just no way. There's no way until you have the everybody play testing it, right? Until everybody plays it and tries it. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, I get a little frustrated sometimes when people, you know, get down on designers and say, well, how'd they let that through? And it's just like, well, now I know you don't know what you're talking about because you've obviously never designed a game or software for that matter, but I'm sorry. I'm getting out of my soapbox about that.
No, but essentially we're human, you know, we make mistakes. I don't want to say that we kind of thrive on them, but we do learn from them.
Sure.
And we definitely become better designers with every mistake that we make. So,
Well, yeah, and it's you know, it's also a matter less. If I view it less as the fixing mistakes, as far as, you know, refinement, right. I think is a much better word. And there's so many factors involved in there. How about for you, Matt? Is there a bar a model must jump before it's going to get some attention?
Sort of. For me, a lot of it comes down to individuals that I respect their opinion a lot and consistently have shown that they have a good idea, and that'll let me review something. So like my playtesters, like I respect all of my playtesters for everything that they do. And they truly like make Malifaux what it is in addition to just me and Kyle. And when one of them says to look at something, that means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. But in addition, there is sort of an intuition to it of, If I go through our forums and read through 300 posts and I remember very one specific at the end, I remembered it for a reason.
Right.
And if I keep running into that same idea and it keeps coming up and it keeps kind of nagging in the back of my head, that's when I really know, like, okay, yeah, this is going to be something I want to touch. At the same time, there are things that I want to touch that other people don't notice, or that just aren't an issue to the general public, even if they're a big issue, but yeah. Just no one has noticed because it's a big issue in this super specific context. And those are the things that are like, okay, this is not something I'm going to touch because we only have so many limited resources to touch when we do a physical errata. That maybe we don't touch those things and move on to the things that people are actively more loud about in a way. It's really important to just kind of have a sense and have that nagging feeling in the back of your head to know that, like, yeah, this is something I want to look at further.
Very, very interesting. So we got past a bit of a milestone here. I mean, dropping a whole new faction and putting the book out, all the models are out there in the wild. I would imagine there's a little bit of a moment where, you know, it's finally the ink is dry. You guys aren't done. And what we're looking at is work that you guys have been doing for a very long time. I'd be interested, Kyle, for you, is there something that you're really excited about coming around the corner?
Yeah. So the Other Side starter box is coming out relatively soon in 2021. It's going to have models that cross over between the Other Side and Malifaux. And it's something we haven't done before. And it's going to have Karai and Sonia playing on both sides on, you know, a 4x6 and a 3x3 in both games. And we're going to see Sonia and Karai and, you know, their company playing in a new way in Malifaux. It's not just an alt sculpt. We're going to see Karai doing different things. We're going to see Sonia doing different things. And the title system is going to get some love in that. And I'm really excited to see how players react to that. I'm excited to give the Other Side some attention because it's a fantastic game. It just needs a starter box. So, you know, we need to get that out there. So,
So Kyle, I was excited about the starter box thinking it was just new sculpts. But the idea that as a Malifaux player that I'm going to be able to revisit Karai and take another look at Sonia is pretty exciting. I mean, we've known that the title system was a thing, but to know that it is closer than maybe a lot of people realized, I think is pretty exciting. How about you, Matt? What are you excited about? What's coming around the corner?
Yeah, first I will mention the title. I think the titles were a horribly guarded secret.
Yeah, they were kind of.
They were like kind of everyone knew they were kind of there.
Yeah.
Also, like, we never really talked about it, but I'm super excited for that box. I'm also very excited for the new starter boxes coming out from Malifaux. We've announced the Bayou starter box, the Explorer starter box, and the Outcast starter box. All of these are new models coming out that are going to be pre-assembled so people can get them right on the table. It comes with a fate deck. It comes with a measuring widget. It comes with scheme markers. It is right enough to get people on the table into play so I can go with my friends to a game store eventually when COVID is done and be like, oh, I'm going to teach you how to play Malifaux. Here's a box, literally pour it on a table and play. And that's really cool for me. It's one of the things I really like about the other side. And we've learned since the other side how to do some things a little bit differently. And so approaching that with Malifaux, and even the first one, I think, coming out is The Outcast. I think we've already kind of talked about that before. Those characters are really fun. The Catlin Corps are really interesting. They help to expand Anya a bit and her crew. Her crew in Explorers is a bit smaller because she has this mercenary outfit that she purchased. And they do some really cool things for her crew, but also bring some love to Outcasts when we haven't touched Outcasts in some time, so that they get some new toys all around. And I think the characters are really interesting. I'm very excited for the other starter boxes. Obviously, Explorers, we've already seen Mr. Nagatoro, Tannenbaum, and the Hopeful Prospects. That'll be a fun way to get people started in the game. And then when we eventually get around to the original Bayou Bash models and them hitting the table, that is a wacky bunch of racers that make for a really fun game.
I am amazed at how sustained the buzz around Bayou Bash has been. I mean, we first heard that term a while ago and people still bring it up. People are still excited to finally take a look at it. So that's great. Well, guys, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I appreciate you taking the time. I know everybody has been very excited to hear kind of your thoughts on the Explorers now that it's all out there. Any last things we want to put out there, Kyle? Any plugs or call outs?
I mean, we've already kind of been speaking the praises of our playtesters, but right now we have two groups of playtesters that are making our games shine in the background. If you're listening, thank you. You are the reason why our games end up working. So
we know it's not Matt. So
my favorite thing is when you give a playtester something, they're like, "This is terrible." Feeling more, I was like, "Cool, I knew it was terrible. Thank you for accepting me.
Thank you for validating me." How about for you, Matt? Any plugs or shout outs?
I will say one other thing that I'm excited for. That's kind of a plug. From Nightmares is coming out soon. I am very excited for that book to explore new content with Through the Breach and explore Neverborn characters to an extent and new magic and all that kind of stuff. That is very, very exciting. I'll also I'll plug you, Craig, Third Floor Wars. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, congrats on 100.
You guys are amazing. Oh, thanks. Thanks, I appreciate that.
And all the other podcasts, I listen to a lot of them and they're all great. And I want people to know that, like, even if you don't think anyone's listening, I'm at least listening, and you should continue what you're doing. It's great to just listen to people's point of view. So
I'll tell you what, guys, I've been excited about we have a little bit of a burst of new podcasts coming out from Malifaux. It's very exciting. Very, very exciting. I've always considered that a good measure of the health of a game is when you have an expanding pool of content creators, and then you can often smell the vultures when things start shrinking, and that is not what we're seeing with Malifaux, which I think is very, very exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool to see how many people are excited, especially just for Explorers. The number of things that, like, right when it came out, people were like, "Oh my god, this is interesting. Here's my thoughts." Like, just all of those are really fun to listen to because you're just like, "I've been working on this for so long." And now you hear, like, voiced opinions rather than just text, which sometimes text is a little boring to read. people can have a conversation. It's great.
And now we're seeing podcasts on not just, you know, the competitive side of the gameplay, but we're also seeing, you know, YouTube content for the lore of the game, which I just love, you know, keep doing that, please. And I'll keep watching. So
even people that are just the steam powered scoundrels and their weird, we're just going to talk about and weird in general, like, they're fun to listen to. And it's a nice break.
There's a reason that he is the first pod I'll listen to. When, as soon as I see it on my catcher and I see a new steam powered scoundrels, it's the first thing I'm going to listen to because I know it's not going to be like, it's going to be unlike anything I've listened to this month.
You have no idea what's coming.
Exactly.
We're like, Craig is just like, here's a Nakima deep dive. You're like, cool, I know I know most of the hits they're going to hit here. Yeah.
You have no idea which way he's going to go, which is great. All right, gentlemen. I do appreciate it. And for those of you who stuck around to the end, thanks for listening. Take care.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. Faux Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next U.S. Faux Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast.
So the last thing is, do I have to get in the car and drive down to Georgia to get RPG Matt on the show, or can I, like, what do I need to do to get him to come on and talk about Through the Breach?
You're gonna have to talk to Kelly, I think.
I will. I've been dying to have him on the show. It was great to talk to him at Gen Con, and the more people I talk to about Through the Breach, the more I read about it and watch actual plays, the more excited I am by that game. I'm excited, hopefully, to talk him into it, especially with this new Neverborn book coming out, because it has created quite a stir. So that's very exciting. And I'll edit this out if we can't, but is there, I was going to ask you guys if there's anything you're excited about, in the near future. I don't know if that's a question you can answer or not. So before I ask it, I thought I'd check with you. Is there anything you can think in your head that you could talk about, or should I just not ask it?
I'm excited what players think about with, the Karai Sonya TOS Malifaux crossover.
Perfect. We're doing. So you have an answer. So I'll ask that. How about you, Matt? Do you have an answer?
I'm excited for the starter boxes.
Okay, cool. All right, so I'll ask the question.
Call me on my craving for dinosaurs, Greg.
You're trying a little bit there. I saw your face light up.
Ninth faction coming in soon. Just dinosaurs.
Jurassic foe.
We often joke about, like, silly ideas for ninth factions of, like, dinosaurs. Just what's a ninth faction? More ninjas?
Morning. Pirates.
I already have the undead pirates, man.
I gotta finish painting mine. I haven't finished. I painted Molly, and then I got stuck doing other stuff. I need to paint the rest of those because that they all look pretty.
It's great. Yeah,
that is a great box. Oh, that's who I interviewed. What's her name that did the art?
Alyssa for
Pirate. Thank you, Alyssa. I had Alyssa on the show. Hasn't come out yet. She was an awesome guest too. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what it was going to be like to have a audio discussion about art, and it ended up being awesome.
She did the art for Bayabash too, which is still coming out.
You know, I'm proud of her because she didn't say anything.
Yeah,
because I didn't know that. Look at her. She's good for her.
She did a lot of different stuff. I couldn't tell you what all it was. I'm not the one like writing the name of the book.
Christmas Rasputina was her.
Yeah.
New Summer. You know, a lot of stuff. She helps us out a lot.
It was really funny. I told her this, you know, I tracked her down because I loved the artwork for the Molly box. And then I, you know, getting ready for the show, I did some more research to figure out some of the other stuff she drew. And I'm like, gee, I was a big fan of her before I even knew like it was all the same person. Like it was like, oh, I love that art and that art. And it was all turned out to be her. She's very talented. And speaks highly of working with you, Kyle, which I thought was weird.
That is weird. That is weird.
Because Matt doesn't do that. Matt doesn't.
Kyle guy.
All right. I'll bring us back and we'll talk about Maxine. All right. So we've already kind of talked about Jetska.
Who?
Then suddenly it's alive again. So
I'm so not happy.
Yeah.
Oh God. I'm going to end up editing that whole segment and put it into the main thing. That was good. All right. I'll bring us back. Talk about Jetson. I'm going to go back to you first, Kyle, to talk about lore. Okay.
Perfect.
All right. These are not going to be deep dives. I'm thinking very, very high level. What I want to do is for each one of them, understand what they are lore wise. So if somebody has never heard who Anya is and the Syndicate are, just, you know, high level, this is where they fit into the world. Right. And then maybe, and Matt, maybe you can even go into it a little bit, like mechanically, what is the overarching theme of them mechanically? What's if I'm going to play Anya, what does that mean versus playing, you know, somebody else, even if it's a different already established master? And then probably the biggest thing I want to focus on is, what are you guys excited about people finding out? So when they finally get Anya on the table and they start using the Syndicate, what are you excited for them to realize, excited for them to discover? Because I think that's a lot of the process that's happening right now. How does that feel?
That works.
Cool. All right. Sure. I'll bring us back. I'm not kidding, dude. I am going to buy that Blaze in the Dark now.
Kyle talks about it constantly.
You're a good salesman, dude. Like, I'm like, ooh, that sounds fun.
It's so good.
I have not heard a bad word spoken about it.
Mm.
It's a lot of, oh, have you heard about Blaze in the Dark? Let's talk about Blaze in the Dark. At this point, I don't want to play it just so I can constantly hear Kyle ask me. It's been a bit of time since we've talked about it, since we're in the office before quarantine, but
yeah, the last time I played it, we modded it so that rather than doing heists, we were ghost busting.
That's so cool.
Going out and finding ghosts and, you know, hunting them down.
Do you like the world, like the setting?
Yeah, there's not really a lot that you need to do as far as, you know, establishing your own canon, because there's enough hooks in there without that you can build on, which is good. Right. You know, it doesn't over establish itself, but it also gives you enough space to kind of create your own thing. And I just like ghosts, you know.
That's
so
cool, man. Anthony, one of the guys that I do RPG stuff with, he's been on the show. He wants to have me play in one of his Ghostbusters game. Like, apparently the new Ghostbuster RPG is supposed to be really good. Like, it doesn't interest me that much, like Ghostbusters doesn't, but, you know, playing a game that Anthony runs does. So we'll see what happens. All right. I will bring us back. And who wants to start the conversation?
Depends on what's it about.
What I want to know, when is the first time someone said we should have explorers as a new faction? I want to go back to that day. Who wants to go back there?
Either one of us, really. All right.
We'll start with you, Kyle.
You volunteered.
I guess so.
You're the last one that said something. That was dumb. All right, I'll bring us back.
Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.